Chapter 1. Baptists, Beards and Burkas. Common Assumptions About Religion. I was brought up in a very multicultural and multi-religious part of South London. Where I lived, you could choose from 1,001 different belief systems, from Buddhism to Judaism, Hinduism to Sikhism, Jainism to humanism, and more. You could even be a Wimbledon football club fan. We called that masochism. Within a mile or two of my home, there were Christian churches, a Sikh Gurdwara, and a couple of mosques. Had they found the funds, the Jedis would no doubt have set up a temple somewhere in the neighbourhood. In recent decades, every time a national census has been taken, many Brits have enjoyed writing things like Jedi in answer to the "What religion are you?" question. They're clearly a force to be reckoned with. As I grew up, religion was everywhere, and despite the predictions of many secularists that it would go the way of vinyl records and flared trousers, 4 decades on from my childhood, religion is still everywhere. And it's growing. According to the latest research from the well-respected Pew Research Center, by 2060, Christianity will have grown to 32% of the world's population, Islam to 31%, and the number of people identifying as atheists or agnostics will have declined to 12.5%. Those are global statistics, but zoom in and you discover religion has not vanished here in the West either, no matter what some overly excitable journalists may claim. While some older, established churches have shrunk, more popular forms of Christianity have sprung up, often invigorated by immigration, which has brought lively forms of the faith from Africa, Asia, and Latin America. Immigration has also imported 1,001 entirely different religions to the West, everything from animism to Zoroastrianism, a literal A to Z of belief systems, all jostling for attention in the religious marketplace. Among these newcomers, particular attention has been focused on Islam, with over 30 million Muslims now living and worshipping in Europe and North America. Even among secular-minded Westerners, often tempted to view religion with suspicion while trying to pretend they're far too sophisticated for such things, religion has simply morphed into other forms, spirituality, for example. I lived for some years in Canada, shortly after emigrating to what friends had told me was a very secular country. I took a short flight from Vancouver to Vancouver Island on a tiny plane that bounced around the sky like a ping-pong ball in a tumble dryer. To distract myself from thinking about unhelpful things like metal fatigue and terminal velocity, I pulled out the in-flight magazine, a glossy little production of about 12 pages. 6 of those pages were given over to an article on ghosts. How to know if your house has one, how to befriend it, how to ensure it brings positive vibes to your life, and so on. Later, waiting to catch the return flight back to Vancouver, I got chatting to a man at an airport coffee stand who told me that he was off to attend a conference to help him discover his inner divinity. "I am God," he announced, "and so are you. By the way, do you know where the washroom is?" All of this in secular Canada. In other Western countries, even atheists have got in on the Spirituality Act, publishing books on topics like how to find spirituality without religion. Given that religion is everywhere and growing, perhaps the biggest question facing us is, how can we live together despite our differences? How do we all get along? A very common answer is, let's affirm that it doesn't matter what you believe, as long as you're sincere. If Christianity works for you, that's great, but if Islam floats your boat, then go for it. After all, aren't all religions essentially the same? That was certainly my assumption growing up in South London. I belonged to a Christian family. Every week we attended the local Baptist church, and as a teenager I enjoyed youth group, Bible studies and, with my friends, working out ways to pass the time during boring sermons, such as rolling marbles beneath the pews and seeing who could get theirs closest to the front of the church without getting caught. While on the weekends, most of the friends I hung out with were Christians. At school, it was an entirely different matter. The high school I attended was full of many different nationalities, especially from the Indian subcontinent, and many of my classmates were Muslims. London's first Muslim mayor, Sadiq Khan, went to the same school as me. If only I'd had the foresight to get his autograph before he became famous. Some of my closest friends at school were Muslims, including my friend Ahmad, who, like me, was an avid member of the school chess club. He and I had both made the same very practical discovery that joining the chess club got you out of playing rugby in the rain. I was a Christian. Ahmad was a Muslim, but we didn't talk about religion. I think we just saw each other as religious, whatever that meant. As a teenager, I never really spent any time at all wondering what my Muslim classmates and friends actually believed. If you'd asked me, I think I would probably have assumed it was broadly similar to what I believed. After all, I went to church, they went to mosque. I read the Bible, they read the Quran. I believed in Jesus, they believed in Muhammad. And all of us got the mickey taken out of us by the atheists in the class, a small but noisily vocal minority, who liked to call all of us, Christians and Muslims alike, religious nutters. So it seemed to me that we were all worshipping the same God in some vague, not quite sure how it all fits together kind of way. In my mind, Muslims were just like Baptists, only with beards and burqas. Assuming similarity. The idea that Muslims and Christians are essentially the same is still doing the rounds today. My naive teenage assumptions have gone mainstream. In particular, one frequently hears people lump together the three major monotheistic religions of Judaism, Christianity, and Islam under the general term Abrahamic faiths. To many people, it seems obvious. Muslims, Christians, and Jews all believe in one God. They all believe in Scripture. They all believe in heaven. Indeed, they even have figures like Abraham in common. As well as appearing in the Bible, in both the Old Testament, the part of the Bible also sacred to Jews, and the New Testament, Abraham is frequently mentioned in the Quran, with an Arabized form of his name, Ibrahim. So surely it's clear that these three religious traditions are branches of the same tree, cousins in the same family. For example, Anglican vicar and journalist Giles Fraser wrote, "Christians should remind themselves that Muslims are our brothers and sisters with whom we share a faith in the living God." While across the Atlantic, in the run-up to the 2020 US presidential election, Joe Biden cheerfully announced, "I wish we taught more in our schools about the Islamic faith. What people don't realize is that we all come from the same root here in terms of our fundamental, basic beliefs." This is not just a popular assumption. One can also find it being expressed by serious-minded scholars. Miroslav Volf, an incredibly highly regarded Christian theologian based at Yale University, wrote a popular book addressing this whole question of the relationship between Christianity and Islam. In the opening pages of Allah, A Christian Response, Volf writes, "Christians and Muslims worship one and the same God. They understand God's character partly differently, but the object of their worship is the same. I reject the idea that Muslims worship a different God than do Jews and Christians." The leader of the Roman Catholic Church, Pope Francis, during a trip to Morocco in 2019, also leapt on the "Hey, isn't it great we believe in the same God?" bandwagon, choosing to pontificate in, of all things, a tweet. "We Christians and Muslims believe in God, the Creator and the Merciful, who created people to live like brothers and sisters, respecting each other in their diversity and helping one another in their needs." To be fair, Pope Francis wasn't entirely innovating here, but reflecting a theme that goes back some 60 years to the Second Vatican Council, which stated that Muslims, together with us, adore the one merciful God. A fascinating survey in 2018 of British and American Christians revealed how versions of this idea are seeping down from the lofty world of theologians, vicars, and popes into the wider church. The market research company ComRes surveyed thousands of Christians about their beliefs and, as part of their survey, asked respondents whether they would agree with the statement, "God accepts the worship of all religions, including Christianity, Judaism, and Islam." 63% of British Christians and 80% of American Christians said that they would. While this may be a watered-down version of the full-fat, super-sized same-God idea, nevertheless, it's still very much in the same ballpark and is one more indicator of how the assumption that religions in general, and Christianity and Islam in particular, are essentially the same, at least in most of the important ways, is becoming ever more mainstream. Putting assumptions to the test. The problem with assumptions is precisely that. They're assumptions. Whether it's a mildly innocuous one, like the assumption that the humble tomato is a vegetable, it's not, it's a fruit, although pointing that out still hasn't made my 5-year-old willing to eat one. Or a piece of folk medical advice, like don't swim within an hour of eating or you'll get cramp. Not true. Besides, if it's the British seaside you're swimming at, you'll freeze to death long before you get cramp. Or my soon-corrected assumption that when you get married, you can carry on all your bachelor domestic habits and your wife won't complain. That one survived less than a month. The thing about assumptions is that it often isn't until we put them to the test that we discover they don't hold up. My own assumption that Christianity and Islam were broadly the same survived my school years and lasted until the late 1990s. Then, one weekend, a visiting speaker came to our church and gave a seminar on how, as Christians, we should engage with our Muslim friends and neighbours. This was the first time that I'd ever really heard anything taught in a systematic way about what Muslims believed. Of course, I'd sat through the mandatory religious studies lessons at school, but those had been pretty cursory and about as exciting as a wet weekend in Milton Keynes. But this speaker was very different. Jay was lively and dynamic and over several hours gave a fascinating overview of Islamic beliefs and history, as well as sharing some of the new discoveries scholars and academics were making about the Quran and the origins of Islam that challenged the traditional story of how the religion began. Then, Jay explained how every Sunday afternoon he was taking groups of Christians to Speakers' Corner to dialogue, debate, and talk about Christianity with the many Muslims to be found there. Speakers' Corner is part of Hyde Park in London, and since the mid-19th century has become affectionately known as the world centre of free speech. At Speakers' Corner, no matter who you are, you can stand on a ladder or a soapbox and talk about anything. Politics, philosophy, religion, sport. And if you're informed, witty, or entertaining, you can draw a crowd. Jay had discovered that Speaker's Corner was a great place for Christians to meet and debate with Muslims. I'd never heard of anything like this before in my life. The Christian tradition I'd been brought up in was fairly quietist. Christians, in my experience, stood on the sidelines, usually dressed in bad knitwear, and politely raised their hands when they wanted to speak, or coughed until somebody noticed them and asked their opinion or offered them a throat sweet. But Christians standing on ladders, talking publicly about what they believed, debating Muslims, getting heckled. It sounded incredible. It sounded amazing. It sounded, frankly, terrifying. "Oh, it's easy," said Jay when I chatted to him over the lunch break. "Why don't you come to Speaker's Corner next week and see what we do?" So the next weekend, I found myself standing outside Marble Arch London Underground station on a soggy Sunday afternoon, not quite sure what I was doing there. A tap on my shoulder startled me, and I turned round to see Jay carrying two stepladders, one slung over each shoulder. "Why have you got two stepladders?" I asked. "One for me, one for you," he replied nonchalantly. I thought you said I should come to see what you do. Well, the best view of Speaker's Corner is from the top of a ladder. Besides, everyone should try street preaching. But I've never preached on the street. It's easy. Now come along, the Muslims are waiting. But I've never debated with a Muslim before. That's easy too. And so it was I found myself, 20 minutes later, balanced atop a wobbly stepladder, surrounded by a crowd of a couple of hundred Muslims, giving a very public demonstration of the fact that just because a large, enthusiastic, bearded American extrovert says something is easy, it isn't necessarily so. To say that my first attempt at street preaching went badly is to flirt wildly with understatement, on a par with describing Mount Everest as bigger than a duck. While it's true, it probably misses something fairly fundamental. Jay has suggested that I try speaking about something simple, for example, tackling the topic, why I'm a Christian. And so I rambled on for a couple of minutes in a feeble voice, barely making myself heard above the rain and the traffic rumbling past on nearby Park Lane. The crowd stared in polite bemusement until I eventually dried up. Jay decided to try to help me out by prompting me with a few questions. He was an old pro and had a voice like a foghorn, so the crowds began to wake up again. But I just froze with fear. So far, so awful. But then the heckling began.
Look at the Christian. He has nothing to say. He has nothing to say because the Bible has no answers. That Christian needs the Quran. Islam is the answer. Allahu Akbar.
Feeling that this was one horrible mistake, I stepped down from the ladder, thinking it best to leave public speaking to the experts, and was promptly surrounded by a throng of Muslims who had a barrage of questions ready for me. Hasn't the Bible been corrupted, and only the Quran perfectly preserved? Asked one man, and before I could think what to say, another piped up with, why do you Christians blaspheme by worshipping Jesus, peace be upon him, who was just a prophet of Allah? I turned to face this new questioner, when somebody from behind shouted,
you Christians say you believe in one God, but talk about the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit, yet 1 + 1 + 1 = 3, not one.
Occasional cries of Allahu Akbar would drift up from the crowd whenever somebody lobbed what the others thought was a particularly tricky theological zinger. I had answers to none of them. So much for Christianity and Islam being broadly the same. My new Muslim friends were very clear that the two religions were wildly different. Only one of them was right, and that was self-evidently Islam. Well, said Jay, stroking his beard thoughtfully as we debriefed later over a coffee, that didn't go too badly for your first time, all things considered. Not too badly, I muttered, drowning my sorrows with a swig of caffeine. Oh, sure. The last newbie I had on the ladder was so traumatised he never came back. Moved to Canada in the end, I think. Looking for the evidence. On the train home, I reflected a lot about what had happened at Speaker's Corner. About how, when I had the chance to talk about my Christian faith, I had nothing to say. And how, when my new Muslim friends had asked questions, I had no answers. But they seemed to know everything about what they believed and had 101 reasons why they thought Islam was true, why they thought Christianity was false, and why they believed I should become a Muslim. I thought about this all the way home and all through the evening, and later I lay awake in bed still chewing things over. Were there no good reasons to be a Christian? Did the Muslims have better answers because Islam was true? I stared restlessly up into the darkness of the bedroom as I pondered these troubling questions until, finally about 3 a.m, my wife, whose patience knows almost no bounds, poked me in the ribs and asked why I was tossing and turning and keeping us both awake. I explained what I was struggling to process, and her wise words were, "Maybe you should read a book or something. Ideally in the morning." Deciding this was a good plan, the following morning I caught the bus into town and paid a visit to the local bookshop, which was one of those delightfully old-fashioned establishments packed to bursting point with rambling miles of endless wooden shelves, creaking under the weight of books of every possible size and shape. I explained my predicament to the man behind the counter, who peered thoughtfully over his glasses at me. "Young man," he said kindly, "you need apologetics."
"Apolo-what-ics?"
I asked. I thought it sounded like some kind of breakfast cereal.
"Apologetics," he repeated. "It's the part of theology concerned with giving reasons and evidence for the Christian faith. You'll find it down there."
He pointed down an aisle.
"Turn left at epistemology, first right at eschatology, and then straight on past hermeneutics."
Rather than ask who Herman was, why he was drunk and why he was into escapology, I hurried off among the shelves and returned a while later with a small pile of books that had caught my eye, all of which, in various ways, promised to equip me with answers to big questions about the Christian faith, or enable me to better understand what my Muslim friends believed, and ask them probing questions too. For the next few weeks, I read voraciously, regularly revisiting the bookshop to purchase more, and when a month later I returned for a second visit to Speaker's Corner, I was feeling decidedly more chipper. I was well read. I felt prepared. I felt confident. I was ready with answers to all the questions and challenges my Muslim friends had asked the last time. What could possibly go wrong? They had new questions. Lots of new questions. Once again, I was surrounded by a throng of Muslims eager to overpower a Christian with objections, difficulties, and dozens of reasons why they thought that, far from Islam and Christian being similar, Islam was superior. Thus, the following day it was back to the bookshop, left at epistemology, right at eschatology, and straight on past hermeneutics, to return with another pile of reading. But for all the hard mental effort of thinking, investigating, and really working out what I believed and why, this was actually fun. And so it became my routine for the next 6 months. Speaker's Corner on Sunday afternoons, reading during the week, and occasional comments from my wife as to whether a different hobby, stamp collecting, competitive cheese making, or lion taming, might be easier. Those 6 months of hard graft, of having my Christian faith challenged at Speaker's Corner, of being forced to read deeply to find out if what I believed was true, and to investigate the foundations of what my Muslim friends believed, all the reading, conversations and debates slowly began to do something to me. They gave me a passion for talking publicly about what I believed and learning to defend it. They kindled a love of learning. I hadn't been to university at this point. I wasn't from a university-attending kind of family. And they stirred in me a love for Muslims. I loved their questions. I admired their passion for what they believed, and I enjoyed their willingness to talk about it boldly without apology. All of this excited me so much that I clearly needed to pursue it further. Before long, I had applied for a 3-year degree course in philosophy and theology. That degree eventually led to doctoral studies and, to cut a long and winding story short, I found myself, some years later, at the end of my academic journey with less hair, a large overdraft, and a PhD in Islamic studies, my thesis focusing on the way that the oral environment of 7th century Arabia had left its mark on the text of the Quran. When I went into full-time study, I had promised my wife, "This will only take 3 years." It had taken 11. Over those 11 years, I studied Christianity and Islam in tremendous detail. I had to learn the languages of the Bible and the Quran and study the original texts. I dived deep into the origins of the two faiths and looked at their histories. I immersed myself in the biographies of their founders, Jesus in the case of Christianity, Muhammad in the case of Islam. The more I studied Christianity and Islam at the highest academic level, the more I was drawn, inexorably, to two conclusions. first, there were major differences between the two religions. Far from being broadly the same with superficial differences, Islam and Christianity were fundamentally different, with mere cosmetic similarities. My old idea that they were all but identical had been based on ignorance. Just as somebody who says, every book in the library is essentially the same, it's only booksellers out for a quick profit who tell you differently, isn't displaying wisdom, but exposing a startling lack of reading, so the person, like my younger self, who opines that Christianity and Islam are more or less the same, probably hasn't taken the time to study them in detail. Once you do, the differences become ever more apparent. More than that, the more deeply I studied them, the more I put in the long hours of forensically examining Islam and Christianity, especially looking at the evidence for the claims made by these two faiths, the more I came to the conclusion that Christianity was true, that there were excellent reasons to believe the Bible, that the claims of Jesus could be put rigorously to the test, and they stood up. After 11 years of painstakingly examining the evidence, I had come to the firm conclusion that Christianity was true, uniquely, exclusively true, and Islam was not merely wholly different, but also false. The claims of Jesus bore the weight of careful scrutiny, while the claims of Muhammad did not. Now, to some people's ears, words as bold as these will sound incredibly arrogant and breathtakingly narrow-minded. We live in an age where people are very nervous of exclusive claims about truth. So, in the next chapter, let's address the elephant in the room. Whether it is a problem to say, my religious beliefs are true and yours are false. Key takeaways. Religion is growing both globally and in the West. Far from ours being a secular age, it is an increasingly religious age. This means that one of the greatest questions facing us in the 21st century is, how can we all live together despite our deep differences in beliefs? The idea that Muslims and Christians worship the same God, that Christianity and Islam are, along with Judaism, part of a great tribe of Abrahamic faiths, is widespread at both academic and popular levels. The assumption that all religions are essentially the same is usually held by people who haven't studied any of them properly. Once you begin studying and comparing any of the world's major faith traditions more deeply, the differences quickly become apparent.